and welcome to episode 9 of the Sanyu Sisters podcast. I'm Tista.
And I'm Amber.
And here in the UK, the Corona coaster continues as we're all getting settled into lockdown 3.0. Are you doing anything new to keep yourself busy, Amber?
Well, there feels like there's plenty keeping me busy, but this week I was really fortunate to receive my vaccine.
Yay!
because I'm still very much working clinically at the moment, so felt mildly ropey for about 24 hours. But apart from that, I've been absolutely fine, and I'm just super grateful to have had it. This week, I also received an email from the Royal College of Obs and Gynae, so I finally got a date for my Part 3 exam. So that's early March. So I think February's probably going to be back to the books for me. But again, third time lucky, cannot wait to get this over and done with. What about you, Tista?
Yeah, no, this week I've been to some really exotic places doing emergency obstetric care teaching in Kenya, collaborating on a grant proposal in South Africa, and submitting ethics approval in Uganda. So it's been very exciting, but sadly this was all virtual. So I never actually left my desk, but roll on the vaccine so the real gallivanting can begin.
Absolutely. We need to get planning our next Sanyu Sisters trip ASAP. I can't believe we're up to episode 9 already. It's crazy. This series really feels like it's flying by, but as ever, it has been so great to catch up with our Sanyu Sisters community.
Definitely. Our last episode was with Benjamin Black, and we've had some wonderful feedback from the listeners. So thank you all so much for tuning in. We're so excited to have been invited to speak at the Liverpool Snogs annual conference, which will be on the 30th of January. All proceeds are going to 3 hugely important charities in maternal and newborn health. So we're really thrilled to be able to support them. Benjamin will also be there and is speaking on a separate event. So we hope you'll be able to join us for this brilliant, brilliant conference.
This week, Tista's been chatting to Adura Bank-Thomas, an expert in maternal health systems at London School of Economics, and he'll be sharing his experiences on how financing for global maternal health has been impacted by the pandemic. Let's have a listen to what Adura has to say.
So I'm so delighted to welcome Adura Bank-Thomas to join us today. Adura is a research fellow at the Department of Health Policy at London School of Economics and a holder of the prestigious AXA Future Research Fellowship. His work primarily focuses on mapping the coverage of critical maternal health services to explore strategies to optimise access, cost-effectiveness and quality of these services in sub-Saharan Africa. He holds a host of achievements, including a medical degree from Lagos State University and 2 master's degrees in public health and health policy and program management. He recently completed his PhD from Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine, during which he pioneered the application of the social return on investment methodology to assess the value for money of maternal health interventions. So given his expertise in health system evaluations, we were so keen to be able to chat to him and hear his thoughts on how COVID has impacted global maternal and newborn health financing. So a big welcome, Adura. How are you doing?
Very well, Tista. Thank you so much for your generous welcome. Thank you. Thank you. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us. So to begin with, can you tell us a little bit about the work that you're involved with and how the pandemic has perhaps changed your work?
Yes. Once again, thank you very much for having me. And I must commend you for this extremely valuable platform that you're building for early career researchers in maternal and newborn health.
Thank you so much. That's so lovely to hear.
To your question, my work has really, like you aptly said, is really focused around issues on cost, the travel and quality in maternal and newborn health, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. In the context of COVID-19, I have been involved in work that really looked at the impact of the pandemic on maternal and newborn health services, including tracking what many have called the indirect impact, or others have aptly described as COVID collaterals that women are experiencing within the context of the pandemic. So how has the pandemic changed my work? what I think it has certainly in the space of actually providing like new substrates on where to anchor my work, COVID-19 has certainly done that. There were issues before the pandemic, and what the COVID-19 has done, it has essentially exacerbated those issues.
Yeah.
And frankly, maybe even exposed deep-seated inequities in health systems all over the globe. Obviously, little was known about the effects of the disease on pregnant women, you know, in the early days of the pandemic. But this has increasingly changed, you know, as researchers are essentially being challenged to push the limit to get evidence that is relevant, not just for women generally, but that is timely and that can come out. And I think for me, that's one thing the pandemic has really done. It has increased the urgency in which we need as researchers to get research out.
And I think that's absolutely right and couldn't agree more. The pandemic has not only highlighted these existing spaces of inequity for women and newborns, but actually worsened them too. And so there is a definite need for timely action now. How do you think that financing for maternal and newborn health systems has changed in light of the pandemic?
I mean, it's a great question that you ask, because there are two sides of the coin for financing, right? There is the side of the cost of actually providing the services, and there is the cost of utilizing the services.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned already, yes, the COVID-19 has been a major disruptor for health systems globally, and its emergence has warranted the need to reorganize maternity services for childbirth, for example. It became clear that we couldn't do things, you know, the way we did things previously. And, you know, in line with this, guidelines have been, you know, have been published, you know, by the World Health Organization, for example, on how, you know, services should be delivered to pregnant women, you know, both those who are suspected and those who are confirmed with COVID-19. However, one question that has remained is, do this come at an additional cost, either for those who are providing the services or for those who have to use the services, that is the women? So in the settings where I work, so I was involved with some colleagues of mine, and when we looked at the cost of utilization of maternal health services in the context of COVID-19, and I don't know if you know that Lagos is the epicenter of COVID-19 in Nigeria, where we've had over 20,000 cases,
gosh,
over 200 deaths. If you compare this to the national average in Nigeria, this is, Lagos is like way, way above many other states. But anyway, in that study, we collected facility-based costs and household-based costs. So facility-based would be cost that the woman had to pay when they got to the facility, and then household will be all the other costs that they would have had to spend related to their hospitalization.
Right, okay.
And we compared the main facility-based cost for the woman who we sampled, who had COVID-19 and were pregnant, with cost of women who came into the hospitals before COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
And we also estimated, you know, what some women would have paid, you know, with or without subsidies, because we were aware that, you know, some governments were supporting women, and anybody who had COVID-19 was being supported financially. What we found was that the cost of just having a baby, either by spontaneous vaginal delivery or cesarean section, had doubled and tripled respectively during the pandemic compared to the pre-pandemic era.
Wow.
And don't forget, this is in a country where women had already complained that the costs were deemed exorbitant. And now we are saying, just to have your baby, women are having to pay two times, three times more than what it was pre-pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
So this is huge. And the major drivers have all now become new cost drivers. So things like women are having to purchase personal protective equipment for health workers and for themselves.
Of course, yeah.
Women are having to pay additional for supplemental oxygen if they require long admission. All of these are driving costs for those who have to provide the care and for those who are having to receive the care. To pull all of that together, this is a huge bottleneck, because look, the reality is somebody has to pay for this.
Yeah.
Either it's the government or the woman. And in a setting, like I mentioned previously, where women were already lamenting that this cost were already so high, I think we're into a new era of really looking critically at how financing is done for maternal and newborn health in the light of the pandemic.
And that's fascinating to hear that it isn't actually just the money given for subsidies that have increased in light of the pandemic, but actually the amount of money that women and their families are having to spend for healthcare too, that has actually increased as well. So actually, if there already has been this existing problem in equity for health, the pandemic is only going to have compounded this further and drive these inequities to be larger than they existed already.
Absolutely.
You mentioned the subsidies that the governments have been giving. Do you think there's been a push for domestic financing and investment in health by countries in light of the pandemic?
Thank you for that question. I mean, there has been a push for domestic financing. And what you have to ask is why? You know, why was this not being done before? I think it's just really because we found ourselves in this very unprecedented times. You know, there have been unprecedented unemployment rates during the COVID-19 pandemic, which has resulted in many more pregnant women having to face health economists call catastrophic health expenditure, like the US. There's increasing unemployment, which has also meant that women who were becoming even more eligible for Medicaid. So really, what is happening right now is that the government are having to support anybody really who requires care, but more so vulnerable people like pregnant women, because otherwise the care cannot be paid for because people don't have jobs, you know, income is not as forthcoming as it was before. So it's really, really difficult time. There have been a lot of non-traditional donors who have come in, you know, philanthropic organizations, charities who have come to support pregnant women. For example, in the study that we did, we found that women were receiving between 30 and 62% of subsidies on the facility-based cost that they paid.
Right, okay.
And this was either because governments were giving exemptions, right, to them. So you don't have to pay this bit. Don't worry. You don't have to pay for feeding. Just stay in the hospital. You don't have to pay for your hospital stay. Mm. Or because private and philanthropic organizations were giving donations, right? In fact, in Lagos, Nigeria, the state government did waive any form of facility-based cost in anybody who had COVID-19, including pregnant women. However, I think what we don't know is how long can this be sustained for? Because look, the pot of money did not suddenly expand because we had COVID-19. You know, absolutely, something is having to give way for this quote-unquote extravagant additional spending that government are coming up with, right? In Lagos, government having to upset as much as between $250 and about $2,500 per day for patients who had COVID-19. So the reality is, I think in advanced settings, you can tell that there is probably a period over the next couple of months where taxation is probably going to increase to recoup some of the monies that government spent. I don't know what's going to happen with many low and middle income country settings. So is it the right direction? I think it's good that in the middle of the crisis, where you can't, you know, you're struggling with something, I'm struggling with something. Normally, I would have come to ask you, please help me, please help me. But now I know you're struggling. I'm also struggling. I needed to look inwards to figure out how can I help myself, right? And I think, yes, is it a step in the right direction? I think it's good that we've been able to identify some of these sources, other sources, and they've come in the middle of the pandemic. But how long is this going to be sustained? I'm sorry, only time can tell.
And I think that's a really fascinating way of sort of putting it, because actually it is that sort of ownership, which is fantastic and is definitely a step in the right direction for the global health community. But as you say, you know, just it's a plaster on a big gaping wound, isn't it? And and actually it's that need to maintain the momentum for investment even past this pandemic.
Absolutely.
The other point that you touched upon was the idea of there isn't this endless pot of money. And I think, as we all know, the global economy has been hit really hard by the pandemic. And the World Bank has actually predicted a reduction in global GDP by about 5.2% in 2020. So many countries, including the UK, have cut foreign aid spending as a result of this. Long term, do you see these cuts in foreign aid spending as a problem or an opportunity for the global health community?
I think this is really a case of a double-edged sword. And I think it really builds on my previous answer, because personally, I've always been of the opinion that low and middle income countries need to be weaned off foreign aid if those health systems are to develop in any cogent way. Because so in the middle of the crisis, the COVID-19 crisis that we found ourselves, there was no time to ask for help from big brother countries. I made previously, well, frankly, like I said, we're really focused on dealing with their own pandemic challenge. I believe after we get past this pandemic, and we will get past this pandemic, right? It will be massively important for us to look at approaches used to source funding, including local private donors, that worked in the middle of the crisis, to see what made them work. And how can they be incentivized to give more? There was certainly some reason why people were pushed to support pregnant women, or frankly, anyone who needed help. And I think it's important to look at how that can be incentivized, you know, and sustained in the long run post-pandemic. However, I also think it's not time to cut overseas development assistance. I do not see, for example, how many LMICs will be able to afford vaccines for their entire population. And not to forget that there are many other programs that are currently running in health systems in LMICs purely based on foreign aid, you know, that have not funded locally. And the reality is that if there's anything that this pandemic has taught us, it is we are in this together. And we need to come out of it together so that we move forward. Trying to cut down funding is only going to slow down progress, and we need to move forward globally. We need to move together. So for me, the timing to cut back is not quite now, but I think this has to be done in a more systematic fashion than saying we are cutting aid and that's it.
And that's a really important point, as even pre-pandemic, existing investment, as we well know, often doesn't actually reach those that are the most vulnerable or the most marginalized communities.
Yes.
I've seen statistics from 2015 showing that even prior to COVID, a gap of $33.5 billion existed required for achieving these SDG targets in maternal, child and adolescent health.
Yes.
So I think there is definitely a very real concern that cutting foreign aid spending without established, consistent donor or domestic funding in place will have a catastrophic impact on maternal and newborn health. In this COVID landscape, with so many competing priorities, do you think there still is a priority for maternal and newborn health financing?
So I think the way to respond to that is to build on some fantastic work that was done by Dingle et al. I think it was published in The Lancet Global Health.
Yes.
And it was very fascinating work because that data was particularly critical. And I think one of the things they showed was that $16 billion was spent on, you know, reproductive, maternal, newborn and child health in 2017. By their estimate, this was the highest amount ever reported. Child health, if I remember, received about half of the disbursements in that year. And this was followed by reproductive health, which was about a third. Maternal health received just about 20% of the work. And so if the question is about priority, is maternal health being prioritized in terms of financing? Not based on the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Maternal and newborn health certainly receives less funding compared to reproductive health, or I would say the more sexy sides of RMNCH, which is reproductive health and child health, you know. And this is a persistent issue that requires urgent attention, with or without COVID-19.
And I really couldn't agree more. This is exactly where attention needs to be. And researchers conducting work into identifying these gaps in investment are really just so key in adding a really robust evidence base and providing weight in order to make a really compelling argument for financing in maternal and newborn health. As we look to the future, how do you think Adura health systems should be arranged in order to be better prepared for any future pandemics?
That's a huge question. And I think we need an entire panel of experts to come on board for that. Look, the vast inequities in maternal and newborn health outcomes that preceded the pandemic. The pandemic is only exacerbated, you know, these long-standing issues, while also simultaneously allowing policymakers, practitioners, researchers, advocates, etc., to reevaluate how we approach and pay for maternal healthcare. I think as we move to the future, it is clear for us all that we need resilient health systems more than ever before. But certainly these also have financial implications. And I would argue that movement towards self-reliance relating to domestic funding really needs to be prioritized.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, there's also the issue about how we reorganize services. And recently, there's been a lot of interest in the use of innovative practices like telemedicine. And some of my colleagues, you know, just put out a preprint of a research on this based on a survey of over 1,000 health workers. And one of the things that they found was, look, while there are positives, you know, some crucial aspects of maternal and newborn healthcare seem difficult to deliver by telemedicine. As it is right now. So certainly more investment on developing telemedicine would help in terms of preparedness for future pandemics. Because look, we all agree this is our reality right now.
Yeah.
It's COVID-19 right now. I genuinely hope we don't have a COVID-21 sometime soon.
Yeah, and it's exactly, I mean, it's also taking stock of these lessons learned so that actually in the future, if there was a further pandemic, that we've actually learned something and we've progressed in some way and there's been an opportunity out of the COVID pandemic that we've learned from.
I think that's where, and you make a very good point there, because the responsiveness of researchers to actually capture these lessons as they're emerging, really, I think that's one of the key takeaways from this. And I know when you talk about takeaways, we kind of assume that we are out of it already. No, we are not. We're still in it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the more we're able to document what's going on right now, the better prepared we will be. One thing to just add here is the governments themselves appear to be keen, at least some governments, are keen on trying to capture these takeaways as they are happening. So I know that some governments who are, you know, having ongoing reflective processes on what's going, you know, what's happening with the COVID-19, you know, how are some of the things that we're doing now, how are they faring? Are they working well? Do they need to be improved? Are there changes that are needed? And people have talked about, and I know it's COVID-19 where we are discussing, but even during the time of the Ebola crisis that happened in West Africa, people talked about some of the Ebola legacy.
Absolutely.
Right? What did we pick from that crisis, that outbreak, that has helped us in responding to COVID-19? And I would argue that many of the West African countries actually built on some of the gains that they've made during that Ebola outbreak, and it helped them to be better prepared now. So I think we need to cascade that even further and build more, capture more of those lessons even now, as you mentioned, and be better prepared as we go forward.
Just interested, as you were talking about these reflective practices that are occurring in country, how have these reflective practices taken place? Is it tracking and monitoring health expenditure? Is it case studies from the field? How have these reflections formed?
So I can give an example of Lagos. I kind of work closely with that government. So I know the state government had set up a team that was capturing this information on the go. And they were reflecting on what, you know, what was happening, how were the policies of the government working, etc. And, you know, there are weekly meetings actually where these briefings take place so that those lessons are not post the pandemic. Those lessons are valuable and have been applied in the middle of the crisis. And I think that's one example I can certainly give. But I think broadly, I think researchers like us need to be involved in that process of documenting these lessons, because these lessons need to be scaled up, don't they? they need to be passed on to other settings that are also struggling with this, with the pandemic, and you know how best to provide care to women. The other thing to probably mention here is that there are a lot of community of practices that are going on right now. Mm-hmm. Some that experts are on such groups, and those are always platforms where you share and learn. All right, this is what's going on in Bangladesh. Fascinating stuff. Maybe try that mm-hmm. in Nigeria or Kenya or India. So I think those platforms are really happening. And I guess one of the reasons why those platforms have become quite popular these days is because really that's the only place we can connect as experts, really, because mm-hmm. we are all on Zoom, and that's your conference right there, you know. So it's good that we've seen the value in this collaborative practices where we can share and learn what's going on the go. I think maybe one other thing we can do better is to get that information to policymakers, you know, in quicker time as researchers.
Yeah, I think that is so true, is actually how dynamic it needs to be from actually assimilating the knowledge, but actually being reactive and quick to change on the ground so that we actually see those impacts quickly and effectively.
Absolutely.
What would you say is one positive lesson that you think you would take forward in your work on financing for health systems that you've learned from the pandemic?
I would say the efficiency of humanity in this challenging times where we've had to generate evidence now and get it to work now, for me, that it's possible that we can do that when adversity is upon us. For me, that's a big lesson that I'm taking away, and it would certainly influence how I work in the future. Because I feel like there's always this lag between when we generate evidence and when it translates into policy.
Yeah.
But if I did a research now that was relevant for COVID-19 and I'm only getting it out there, you know, in 2022, that is not COVID-19 anymore, is it? Being a researcher and actually thinking about the research and immediately thinking of how do I get this into making a difference now?
Yeah.
For me, that's a big possible lesson that I'm taking away from this process. You know, it certainly worked with us with the work we did in Lagos, where we looked at cost of utilizing maternal health services. And for me, I'm hoping that I'm taking that with me out of pandemic times. And I'm hoping that in the future, as I do research, I'll be able to link that evidence directly, engage the policy people right from the top, make sure you're responding to a need, make them also see the reason why the research that you're trying to get out is particularly important for them now.
That, I mean, and that's hugely important because it is that concept of impact. What is the point of doing this research? Why are we doing this?
Yeah.
And actually having the goal in mind to start with can actually make the work that you're doing the most productive that it can be.
Absolutely.
And I think exactly what you were saying about engaging with policymakers right from the start and not leaving that till the end is actually a really useful and helpful tip to all researchers out there in terms of if you want to make your research as impactful or relevant as possible, that's probably a best way to go about it.
Absolutely. And timeliness, actually, I think timeliness, I mean, there were some times when I picked up platforms like, you know, DHS, and you're trying to do secondary data analysis, and I remember giving this example once on when we were doing a study on adolescent maternal health service utilization, and we were using DHS, or there were some studies that we picked up then, they were using DHS data that was like 7-10 years old, and I was like, an adolescent of that time is not the same, you know. They don't have Facebook and Twitter and all those platforms to deal with. You know? So, you know, we have to be proactive. Our evidence has to be relevant for the times. And for me, COVID-19 just really made it clear how if we're doing research, if we're able to get it out when the metal is hot, that's perfect timing. That is when it's most valuable for policymakers.
And what a fantastic and inspiring message to end on. And I completely agree. As researchers, we play a really important role in creating that evidence for impact. And that's quite a responsibility.
Yes.
So as you say, we really need to be dynamic and respond in a timely fashion to where the need actually is. Thank you so much, Adora, for joining us for today's episode. It's been an absolute pleasure to be able to chat to you about how health financing for maternal and newborn health has been impacted by the pandemic.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure.
So, Amber, what did you think?
I really, really enjoyed everything that Adura was sharing. I'll be honest, Tista, health financing isn't really something I know a huge amount about. So it was just really great to understand that a bit more. And I would agree with what Adura mentioned about COVID forcing us to rethink what we've previously done within health systems, encouraging us into a new way of working, but also that need for high quality research to answer questions as they come up and producing results that are very much real time.
Yeah.
We need these answers imminently. And then I think once we have the results, not to dilly-dally about and be a couple of years down the line before we see any implementation, but to use these results to add weight to the evidence base that then can influence policymakers. It reminds me of what Hannah McCauley shared about her work in episode 2, about using her research opportunistically to answer COVID-related research questions, which they immediately fed back to the Minister of Health, and that was used to cause change. I was shocked about the statistics he mentioned about the cost of giving birth in a healthcare facility, that it's doubled or tripled since COVID arrived in order to cover the cost for staff and patient PPE, oxygen therapy.
I know.
And I guess someone has to foot that bill ultimately. And it's a question of whether it'll be the patient or the government. If only money grew on trees, eh? And Adura did touch on that, thinking about sustainability. So the government, he made an example of, you know, them waiving healthcare facility fees for people with COVID. But I guess that pot comes to an end probably fairly quickly. So I think there was so much to think about within that sort of concept. And yeah, plenty more we could be exploring. What about you, Tista?
Yeah, I really loved chatting to Adura about global health financing. And just like you, Amber, I think coming from a clinical background, financing is a part of global health that I haven't had as much exposure to. So it was brilliant to be able to speak to Adura, who has so much expertise in this field and is clearly so dynamic and passionate about it too. I definitely learned a great deal from him. I think what he highlighted really well was how the wider collateral damage of the pandemic in terms of unemployment and poverty has fed into healthcare financing, and that these problems and struggles are global, regardless of country wealth status. And that goes back to what Benjamin mentioned last week about the changing in direction of knowledge exchange, and that we need to collaborate and learn from each other. Again, Amber, I think we're hearing this importance for high-income settings to be cognizant of the value of turning to and learning from low-income settings if we're really going to progress and find meaningful solutions. And that essentially is global health. I also loved his optimism that although the pandemic has unmasked these deep-seated inequities in maternal and newborn health, it's been a catalyst for change and growth, that we can't do things as we've done them before. So whether this means creating and disseminating research in real time, uncovering new philanthropic organizations and funders, or moving towards self-reliance and away from foreign aid spending, progress is happening. And that said, I think Adura is absolutely right. We now need to be conscious of where we go from here. How can we ensure the gains that we've made are sustained? It can't happen overnight. But I do agree with him. It is definitely a step in the right direction. So, yeah, I really came away from the interview feeling energized and motivated and ready to work on some incredible projects in this space.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you on that. And what did you think at home? If you've enjoyed today's episode, please let us know on our Twitter at Sunny Sisters or Instagram at Sunny Sisters Podcast to keep that conversation going.
Next week will be our last episode of the series. I know, where Amber and I hope to take stock of the key themes and lessons we've learned from our fantastic guests across the past 9 episodes. We have plenty more planned for 2021, and we can't wait to share that with you. But we're so excited to have the opportunity to look back before we step forward. We can't wait for you to join us then. Until next time.